Angie has made it easier than ever to hire high-quality pros to get all your home service jobs done well. Just bring them your project online or with the Angie app, answer a few questions, and Angie will connect you with local pros who match your specific needs. Or book a service instantly at an upfront price. So join the millions of homeowners who use Angie to care for their homes and get your next home service job done well. Download the free Angie mobile app today or visit Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I.com.
You wanted to fight a war? We just did. And we utterly and irrevocably lost. That is a matter of opinion.
Five's a tough one. A presidency gets brought down. The United States of America changes because of these guys. But they don't fucking care. They're in prison.
This is David Mendel, the director. He explained how he capped off a telling of one of the most notable events in American history.
It was this challenge of how do you wrap up this story? How do you wrap up Watergate and everything that happened because of it? And yet keep to our mission statement of it is these two guys, it's these guys that we normally don't care about, and tell that story. And I don't want to sort of say the whole thing is one giant epilogue, but it is a little bit of like, it's almost like the entire fifth episode is what happened.
I'm going to let you in on a secret. When I first watched White House Plumbers months ago on digital screeners, it turned out that I had only received episodes 1 through 4. So for a couple days after, I truly thought that the limited series ended on that plane crash. Then I got episode 5, and the whole thing made a lot more sense. But I do understand what Mendel's talking about here. Episode 5 is, in some ways, an epilogue to the drama, summing up and commenting on everything that Liddy and Hunt have been through.
They never spoke again. They never spoke again. When he basically said, I'm gonna talk, and they never spoke again. And it's tragic in a way because they were fun together. They were a great couple, you know.
It's the breakup. Sort of,
yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's the breakup. So there you go. It's the breakup. There you go. Episode 5, the breakup.
From HBO and Campside Media, this is the final episode of the White House Plumbers podcast. I'm your host, Olivia Nuzzi. I want to start where the last episode of our podcast left off, on the death of Dorothy Hunt.
If it wasn't an accident, then Dorothy's plane had nothing to do with our little trip to Dallas all those years ago. You understand me?
I think so.
Everyone we talked to seemed to have their own ideas about what happened.
Did the CIA or the Nixon administration take down a 727 to kill Howard Hunt's wife?
The FBI beat the fire department to the crash. Bizarre.
They get a new head of the NTSB to investigate it? They fire the old guy? Come on, wait a minute. Of course they killed her.
I look at our government as fascism with a smiley face. You know, you killed all these people just to kill her. Yeah, what do they care?
So we decided to go to an expert, Garrett Graff, the author of Watergate, A New History, which was just announced as a finalist for the 2023 Pulitzer Prize in History.
What I sort of will say or can say is that plane crash has always figured big in conspiracy theories around Watergate. This is part of what makes Watergate so fascinating, that despite it being one of the best covered, most exhaustively researched and investigated moments in American history, there's still a lot we don't know about what happened and who did what.
One big question that the show highlights is the involvement of Bud Krog. Remember Krog?
I have to say, fellas, I'm impressed.
He's the guy from episode 1 who helps assemble the plumbers and then is promptly removed from their team. In episode 5, McCord, played by Toby Huss, arrives at Dorothy's funeral to taunt Hunt with an update on Bud Krog. He also brought a casserole.
Did you see that Nixon named a new Undersecretary of Transportation? One of his boys. Eagle Krog.
Bud Krog?
Yes.
I hadn't heard that.
You see, it turns out now this Crow fella has oversight over all FAA and NTSB investigations, including plane crashes.
Graf explained.
So part of what happens after Nixon wins re-election in 72 is that he has all of these people who have done all of these dirty things for him that he needs to keep happy. They have this huge purge of his administration as they try to reshuffle staff and want to find something for Bud Crow to do. But he knows too much, and so they can't actually put him up for anything that requires Senate confirmation. So basically the highest ranking open position that they can find for him is as Undersecretary of Transportation. And he gets sort of shuffled off over there. It becomes a key point in the conspiracy theories around the Dorothy Hunt plane crash that this sort of member of SEIU is now the guy in charge of, you know, a big chunk of the Department of Transportation. Except, remember the reason that Bud Crow is thrown off of the plumbers in the first place is because he doesn't think they are doing the right thing.
Keep me briefed.
So I'm clear, Bud.
The president doesn't think he has the stomach for bare-knuckle tactics. Too much little old lady in him.
The idea that he is the moral compass in 71 and that by 72 he's covering up a nefarious plane crash strikes me as difficult to believe.
Okay, fine. But what about the life insurance?
Did you know that Dorothy took out a $200,000 life insurance policy right before she stepped on that plane?
The fact that Dorothy took out a policy on her way to the airport is pretty suspicious, right? It suggests that she felt that her life was in danger. Well, Graf had an explanation for that, too.
So that is true. Dorothy Hunt does take out this life insurance policy on the way to this flight. That was also a much more common thing to do then. There were a lot more plane crashes. Flying was genuinely dangerous in a way that it's, you know, not today. And so that was something that you would do at the airport. There were stands there that would sort of sell you a life insurance policy, you know, like at the gate on your way out the door. As someone who has covered government and national security for 20 years, my problem with government conspiracy theories is that they presuppose a level of competence that is not on display in the rest of the work that the government does. That rings true to me with this plane crash that I've never sort of quite understood why downing this flight would be a smart idea for anyone involved, let alone something that someone could actually carry out successfully.
Fair enough. But despite all of this, I still have a hard time letting go of the feeling that something cynical went down. Mandel told me that he felt the same.
I'm not saying they blew up a plane. I'm just saying they were there. And so I tried to put the map points down that allow you to go down a conspiracy path, but I truly don't know. I'm a conspiracy guy. I love a good conspiracy.
I do too. I'm also a conspiracy guy.
Yeah.
And there is something sort of comical about the idea that the Nixon administration fucked up a break-in, but pulled off a plane crash.
But miraculously, they didn't hit, like, they flew into, they crashed a plane in Chicago and didn't kill 4 million other people. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's that too, which is, that's some good flying.
Yeah. Do you believe it?
Kinda. Yeah. I want to believe it. I know, is that bad?
I think people want to believe conspiracies in general because it makes us think that there's order in the universe.
Yeah.
The 1970s was precisely the time when conspiracy theories picked up steam in American culture. Executive producer Frank Rich remembers this period.
After the Kennedy assassination, at least in my lifetime, the Kennedy assassination introduced the idea of rampant conspiracy theory could take more seriously. I remember, you know, being told by my parents about the John Birch Society and that they believed that, you know, Eisenhower was a communist and fluoridation was an attempt to poison American children. At the time, as a, you know, a Nixon-hating young person, I was perfectly willing to believe that Nixon had engineered this crash.
You thought that at the time?
Yeah, I mean, I was willing to believe it. I maybe if someone had said, do you really believe it? And if you're wrong, you'll go to your grave. Maybe I wouldn't have. But no, I assumed the worst of Nixon. You know, hating Nixon was a bigger religion than Judaism in my household.
In episode 5, we feel Dorothy's absence. At the same time, another character reappears, John Dean.
Well, this must be the master spy.
Howard Hunt, John Dean, White House Counsel.
I talked to Mandel about him.
Can you talk about Dean as a character and how you chose to portray him here? It's very different, certainly, from the kind of heroic John Dean of the Resistance Trump era.
This is a very strange thing to say out loud. John Dean, I am a great admirer of John Dean and everything that he has done with his life and everything, all his speaking out against Trump and all of that stuff. So I am a fan. I will also simply say, I think people forget, and maybe occasionally Mr. Dean would like to forget, that what allowed John Dean to do the right thing was initially perhaps not doing the right thing. Is that a delicate way? Yes, perhaps, allegedly.
He did perhaps go to jail.
No, I mean, look, it is this fact, which is, I don't know how to say this, John Dean was very involved in this thing until he was not.
Because he had such an iconic presence in was, American history of the hearings.
I only know that I learned upon my return to the office that events had occurred that indicated that calls had come from Key Biscayne to Washington to Mr. Strawn to destroy incriminating documents in the possession of Mr. Haldeman.
Not that you need a bad guy per se, but you certainly need an antagonist, I'll simply say. If I'm just to talk about dramatic structure for a minute, someone needs to be the antagonist, and a little bit of that needs to be someone needs to represent the Nixon administration in this case, and he was the face of it in their world, and
literally,
in a suave, manipulative way. But let's go one step further. I mean, he was like Washington, D.C.'s most eligible bachelor.
No, I just want to say that Washington, D.C. is an unattractive city, I would say. And for someone to become a sex symbol in Washington, you know, it's not Hollywood.
Allegedly, he cut quite a
but he was very dapper. He had a very beautiful wife.
Yes.
Has a very beautiful wife.
John Dean is probably the most complicated figure in all of Watergate.
Here's Garrett Graff again.
He plays his cards incredibly carefully throughout this time period and is an enthusiastic and willing participant in the cover-up right up until the moment that he realizes that the cover-up probably isn't going to hold. And then, you know, does what every criminal defense attorney will tell you is the right thing to do, is that if you are going to flip on a conspiracy, you want to be the first one to flip.
You know, 80 million people watch my testimony on TV.
It was honestly riveting every moment. John?
Well, yeah.
He starts cooperating with prosecutors first and sort of comes out with this lionized national reputation after the hearings, even though he was an incredibly central figure in some of the worst abuses of the Watergate era.
John Dean doesn't get a lot of screen time in White House Plumbers, but he still looms large, and a lot of that is thanks to the actor who plays him, Donald Gleason.
I just couldn't believe they were going to fly me to America to do that amount of scenes. I was like, John Dean's not in this a lot. Like, they're going to fly me out for like 7 scenes? They're like, yeah. And I was like, absolutely, sign me up.
We talked to Donal from his home in Ireland. He told us that one thing Dean was known for was his look.
He wore slightly flashier clothes. They weren't green in his haircut. The slightly older guys, you know, Ehrlichman and those, they were just like, this guy is parading around in his fast car. They were like,
this is not the way we do things. He had an air about him that was very, very self, like very sure of himself. And that's a very attractive quality. And then all of a sudden, he's also working in the White House. And depending on who you are, that can also be a very attractive quality. You know, power is an aphrodisiac and all the rest of it.
Donald noticed that the feeling is especially strong in big American cities like D.C. and New York.
Holy moly. The vibe there is like inspiring and seductive in a way that feels like dangerous in all the wrong ways. Like just the feeling of power in those places, you're changing the world. Like you're shaping the world every day. And so if you feel like you're having a bad day and somebody isn't making your day easier, you'd be like, fuck you. If I have a bad day, the country suffers. I remember the first time I walked around New York, I remember thinking, oh, that's why Americans are not like that. But but the first time I walked around New York and just the size and scale of the place, I was like, these people must feel like they run the world. You know what I mean? Like, it's just a different thing than walking around Dublin. It is.
When it came to his physical transformation for the role, the big thing that Donal had to wrestle with was his hair.
It involved a big dye job at the beginning of the job because I'm very, very ginger. And weirdly, a weird fact about John Dean is he looks like blonde in some photographs and then a brunette in other photographs. Depending on how the light hit his hair, he looks like this is the most boring fact that's ever been. But anyway, we were like, what the hell color is his hair? And I think Mandel, somebody was like, you can't even trust the color of his hair. Like, this is, you know, this is, you know. But it was, it's like getting that pinned down and finding the look was like, that took a good while.
We talked to two department heads, Kat Drazen, who was in charge of hair, and Sarit Klein, who did makeup, about nailing down Dean's coloring.
So with Donal, he naturally is much lighter. He's a much lighter shade of red, and his hair was quite long, which worked in the sense that John Dean's hair was a little bit longer than the politician or one involved in government at that particular time. But when he arrived in the States, his hair was down to his shoulders. And what we wanted to see, my guidelines and parameters, was a really cool shade of warm brown, like almost red, but not really red, not shockingly red, muted, but warm and feathery and kind of cool because he had this like hip attitude.
Well, I think for me, makeup wise, his face shape and his coloring is very different than John Dean. He's much, much lighter and his lashes were almost invisible. So after Kat and her team decided on the color, we looked at all the pictures of John Dean and we tinted his lashes darker and used a bronzing tint to get him closer to John Dean's skin tone. And also, because Donald's face shape is much longer than John Dean's, John Dean was rounder, we elongated his facial hair, his sideburns, that didn't necessarily match John Dean, but looked and matched more of Donald's essence of the character.
Donal told us that Mandel and the writers wanted the John Dean that turned up on the stand in episode 5 to be different from the one we'd seen before that.
I'll see you around, Gordon.
Nice glasses, John.
Here, Dean would be contrite, respectful.
They wanted him to have changed up to present a more trustworthy version of himself, I think. A serious man at the trial. He's wearing glasses, he's got his hair stick down a little bit more, whereas before that he was just a little bit more
disloyalty, but showy, rather in the end,
I suppose.
It would be an act of loyalty. I had told Haldeman about the meeting in Mitchell's office. The president, almost from the outset, began asking me a number of leading questions.
Look at that fine, blonde piece of ass Dean. Fuck.
Shh. We will never know for sure what his real reasons were doing it, or whether the reasons that he says are the reasons he did it, what the subconscious thought there was true, even if his conscious thought was, you know, like there's no way for us to know for sure, but I feel like I know what the show thinks. And when I watch him try to explain himself to Liddy, there's a desperation for approval from somebody who he has looked down on for the rest of the show.
Well, look, like you, I was prepared to do whatever it took to protect the president.
For somebody who's a true convert, a true believer, the need for approval from somebody like that in that moment, I think, tells you everything you need to know.
In the case of the United States versus George Gordon Liddy et al., we find the defendant guilty.
Much of episode 5 goes down inside a new location, the jail.
Welcome to Camp Shithole.
Bienvenido.
How is it?
We've been in worse. Fellas, dreadfully sorry.
The production designer, Anastasia White, told us about that set.
One little Easter egg detail was that David wanted to make the floors black and white. So it was sort of, in a way, imitating what the EOB hallway is like. The original prison floor was just a concrete slab. So we had to add tiles, linoleum tiles, to the prison. Luckily, we could do whatever we wanted because it was about to be torn down. We just kind of wanted something that had like a repetition and a rhythm to it. So it was just, that was sort of the language of the prison, because it was sort of stemming from their entry into this whole fiasco, which was at the EOB in the hallways.
A lot goes down in the jail. But early on, Hunt is actually moved to the hospital after he suffers a stroke in the rec room while watching Dean testify on TV.
Dean sold us out! We are going to die in here. We're never getting out. We're never...
There's a great story behind that scene that Justin and Woody laid out for us.
I'm supposed to, in a very kind of, you know, officer and a gentleman way, you know, go like, oh my God, you know, and then grab him and then thrust him up and then march off holding him, you know, like, out of the way, gentlemen. You know, my friend is dying.
Howard? Oh, shit.
That motherfucker's dead.
Not on my watch.
And, you know, we did it the beginning part of the scene. And then, it, you know, I'm going to have to lift a guy who's probably 160 pounds, if I'm being generous, Woody. But I was going to have to, like, from him lying on the ground, I'm going to have to squat down, grab him by the neck and the legs and pick him up. And I was like, Woody, I only want to do this, like, once or twice. I don't want to – let's just be aware that I have, you know, a back and I have legs and knees and I don't want them to be shot by the end of the day. So he said, oh, yeah, let's just do it. And so I said, look, so let's please not fuck around. And then I it was action. He clutched his heart. He gave actually a very moving performance, leaned forward, fell to the ground. And then I went down to pick him up.
Come on.
And I picked him up and it was, I felt like blood vessels behind my eyes bursting as I was trying to lift him up and veins were shooting out of my forehead. And I finally got him up and I felt like I was literally had about six hernias and then marched off thing. And then he started laughing so hard and he started taking off his prison clothes and he had had the crew give him like a weight vest. He had sandbags in his like gut. He had his entire body was covered with and taped with sandbags. So I was probably lifting, no joke, about 350 pounds of Woody.
When he tried to lift me up, which was captured on film, by the way, we've watched it back several times. It is just a wonderful thing because the strain, and he's a strong guy, but the strain was rather uniquely big because he just wasn't expecting it. But when he finally, I started revealing all the sandbags. Oh, man. It was just so worth it to see his face.
Leah Katz Nelson was the costume designer on White House Plumbers. That meant that she and her team actually designed those prison uniforms and created them from scratch. Just before shooting the scene, Woody came to Leah with a request.
It was maybe a couple days before he decided to do it. And when he came to me and said, I have this idea and I want to add these weights to my body and prank Justin when we shoot this scene, can we do it? The first thing I thought was, well, your uniform is custom made. It's a made-to-order uniform that took months for us to craft. So when you add this new volume, this new bulk, it requires a new uniform. The props department supplied the weights for us. We tested out a couple of different ones to see what would fit Woody most comfortably. And then we took measurements and, you know, adjusted and graded our uniform accordingly. So we did construct a new uniform for him just for this prank. It was worth it. They're like brothers, Woody and Justin.
Hunt did actually suffer a stroke in prison, by the way. Liddy carrying him away to receive care? Probably not, but one of the most bizarre developments in the episode might be Liddy pulling a kind of Shawshank Redemption and helping out a bunch of his fellow inmates. Oh,
I am getting retrials for a lot of the Negro inmates. Turns out, a lot of these fellows were wrongly convicted.
I asked Mandel about that. Did Liddy help black inmates?
Yes. He did a couple of crazy things. He bugged the warden's phone, actually.
What?
And then tried to blackmail the warden. I think we actually, at some point, we tried a joke about, like, I did it right this time. You know, it was like one of those things. But no, became this, you know, prison sort of courthouse lawyer, prison lawyer sort of advocate for.
And well-liked among
inmates.
Yes,
very well-liked.
Yeah. I guess that tracks. You could see a personality like that finding prison very clarifying.
Yes, exactly. It kind of very simplifies life.
Oh, and you are going to love this. I am this close to getting kosher meals for one of our Jewish inmates.
One of the writers, Alex Gregory, weighed in on it too.
Liddy really does have a Nazi fetish. At the same time, he's not a Nazi. It's a weird distinction. But in his book, he goes to great lengths to talk about kosher meals for the Jewish inmates and was an advocate for the Black and Latino population who he realized had been unfairly convicted. And so parallel to this insane Nazi stuff, he really would, like, that moment where the crowd applauded and he gave them the Nazi salute, happened. That happened. That's what was so bizarre about him, is he's a complete paradox. There's like a weird kindness to him and then this Nazi boner, which makes no sense other than it got him through his days of being bullied. So that was really important to us that we actually showed that moment. But then at the same time, didn't let him off the hook. He really did do the Nazi salute to a bunch of black inmates. It's insane.
Haltetaus, Haltetaus, lasset hoch das Banner wehen, zeiget ihn. That was probably the best Liddy's life ever gets in the sort of course of our series.
Justin Theroux, who played Liddy, was also intrigued by where Liddy ended up.
Like, when he finally got to prison, I feel like that was his Shangri-La. He was in heaven. He was like, I have proven myself, you know, and it's a perfect place for him to sort of not break, you know. I mean, the trajectory of everyone's story is from the Cubans to Hunt to, you know, everybody is just a downward spiral. It is the exact opposite for Liddy. It is like an upward slide. You know, like his story is success, 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 even though in total failure. You know, I think everything was sort of seen as a win, you know, and a way to prove himself.
All of Liddy's masculine posturing, it's a good match for prison life. He actually thrives there all the way up to 1977, when President Carter made the surprising decision to commute Liddy's sentence. Liddy became eligible for parole a few months later, having served only 4.5 years of his original 20-year sentence.
I still think it's bananas. He would have done 20 years, you know, maybe time reduced for good behavior, but he would have done 20 years in there. He wasn't asking for pardons. He wasn't like Bannon, who was, you know, saying like, hey, by the way, can you pardon me on the way out? He was willing to do the time. And I just think it was crazy that he was in there. After they had all sort of flipped and cut deals and were out, he was still sitting in prison just going, no fucking way.
Despite all of the guy's issues and appalling idiosyncrasies, Justin told us that he really formed a connection to Liddy, at least enough of one to embody him in a truthful way.
You have to really sort of fall in love with the character you're playing, which I did. And you also have to not judge the character you're playing because you're having to serve their point of view. And so I really started to like become a little bit of a Liddy head. I wasn't converted, you know, at the end of the day to his political beliefs and his desire to undermine a free and democratic election. But my takeaways were that he was an optimist. And when you look into his personal life, you know, he had, I think, a very strong love for his family and his children and his wife. So there were a lot of admirable things that I really liked about him. And he was, for better or worse, a real scrapper who he did have a moral code that he lived by.
Early on in his process, Justin decided that he wanted to meet the real Liddy, to chat with him one-on-one and to get a sense of him as a person. But it was complicated.
I sort of said, hey, why don't I reach out to Liddy and see if he'll sit down with me? And we didn't really know where to land. And I think it kind of gave them the, I don't know if it's, you know, smart, you know. And it is always kind of a catch-22 when you're playing someone who's alive, in that you don't want to become an acolyte of them and you don't want to let them sway you into, you know, I would, of course, loved it just observationally, you know, just to see how he really was in real life. And I, to this day, kind of regret not having met him because I think it would have been beneficial. But they had persuaded me not to. Then he died, which was, I mean, I didn't take it hard, but I was upset. I was kind of like, oh, this is traumatic. And we were shooting upstate right where he had lived for so long.
He died before we started shooting, and they buried him when we were up there. And he's from Poughkeepsie, and they buried him in Poughkeepsie.
Weird.
And Justin, who is a bit of an artist, went and made a tombstone rubbing of Liddy's tombstone and gave it to me as my rap gift, which is one of the coolest things I have/have ever been given in my life.
I found out where his wife was buried and sort of on a hunch thought, oh, maybe he's buried there too now. It was about a month after he died. And sure enough, I found this. I went in and I said, hey, do you know where G. Gordon Liddy is buried? And they said, yeah, he's you know, somewhere over there, whatever. So I went over and it was kind of sweet. It was a big, beautiful gravestone, sort of out of the way. And he was buried right next to his wife. And the grave that he was buried in was fresh. So, you know, she had a big, nice plot of grass over her. And his still had sort of dirt and was just starting to sprout. So I, as a wrap present to a couple people, I went and did sort of one of those charcoal rubbings. You know, you put a piece of paper up on the gravestone where it says Liddy, and I sort of did a charcoal rubbing of his gravestone. I ended up really adoring him. He lived exactly the life he wanted to live, which is, I guess, admirable. He made certain choices that I wouldn't necessarily make, but I guess we all did.
Unlike almost all of the other defendants and Watergate conspirators, Liddy maintained his stone wall of silence. He didn't speak publicly about Watergate until the early 1980s, when the statute of limitations ran out. That's when he wrote his memoir, Will, which became a runaway bestseller. Liddy's loyalty to Nixon, his true believerism, as Mandel puts it, was so ingrained that he was even willing to do something once unthinkable, off his former best friend. Here's Mandel.
My favorite scene in Five, and I like a lot, but I think my favorite scene is when Hunt tells him, I'm gonna talk, and they get called to dinner. That moment of him walking out of the prison cell with Liddy behind him, and you just that sense of like, is he going to kill Hunt? Like, what's about to happen here? What's going on? And then all of a sudden he punches the guard and you're confused for a second.
Two cartons of Pall Malls.
Take that motherfucker solitary.
And then you realize, well, that's part of that larger idea of he's going to be put in solitary so that when someone else kills Hunt, he'll be innocent of it. And you kind of, all of that kind of hits you and hits Hunt, and then it dissolves very slowly to Hunt in the hearing room and the picture of Nixon on the wall, and he's about to finally testify. There's something about, again, that is the end of those guys.
Yeah.
and everything that's a part of it.
It seems so improbable that Liddy would actually offer to have Hunt killed, but Garrett Graff confirmed it.
He actually really does plot behind closed door, you know, behind prison bars to kill Hunt if he needed to. He thinks he will get an order from the White House at some point to kill Hunt.
To ensure his enduring silence, I am prepared to use any and all means and methods at my disposal. Think about it. I will wait for a signal.
So he sort of figures out how he would do it in prison. And of course, no order comes from the White House, and nor is there any evidence that any such order was ever contemplated. You know, this seems like it was just another case of Gordon Liddy's incredible imagination run amok again.
At this point in the story, Hunt and Liddy are finished. Not only is the bromance severed, but the two guys actually become estranged. Here's Alex.
The most important thing was that the two guys never spoke to each other ever again. Is that they had this incredible adventure that changed the course of American history. They became inseparable friends, and then Liddy really set up a situation where he could have had Hunt killed and was waiting for the order to have Hunt killed. And again, that's part of the fanaticism, is the cause supersedes all humanity.
The final shot of White House plumbers really drives this point home.
Escuchaste. El presidente Nixon renunció.
Nixon resigned. They were that.
Flying back to California, he forgot to take you, Watergate.
It features Hunt bending over a table in the prison laundry room, sweat beating on his forehead as he irons a load of white t-shirts. I discussed the ending with David Mendel.
At the end of the show, Hunt's just in the laundry room doing laundry in prison and kind of hears in Spanish from another guy that Nixon resigned and flew home. And that's it.
The smallness of that.
The smallness of it, exactly. And I won't lie, we experimented with a piece of footage. You know, we looked at footage. Should there be a footage? Should we do the, you know, the getting on the helicopter shot?
I like doing the V for Victory.
I like to call it the Selina Meyer shot. you know, I looked at it. Looked at doing it, and again, it fought the smallness. It fought the I'm in prison laundering shirts, and this guy stepped down, and not that it's in there at that moment. Mm-hmm. Won't be charged with anything, and I'm here.
Initially, there were a couple of other scenes written after the laundry, including one where William F. Buckley interviews Hunt on his show, Firing Line. Another one portrayed Hunt, years later, out of prison, remarried and living with Lisa on a farm. But eventually, the team decided to cut these tailpieces, ending on Hunt, a guy who's probably never done laundry in his life, toiling away over t-shirts. Was just too good. Mendel and the writers, Alex Gregory and Peter Hike, talked about the power of that final image.
This is a show where a guy needs to end in prison, both literally and figuratively, for his crimes, both against, I guess, the United States of America, but also what a shitty dad and husband he was. I mean, that's the end. And in some ways, a little bit of like, oh, he's on a talk show. Oh, he made amends with his daughter. It almost was, I don't know, giving him a little bit of a get out of jail free card, if excuse the bad pun. Better to end in jail. You know what I mean?
Hunt is the poster child for the patriarchy. You know, he's all about the establishment. He's all about projecting an image of elite success. His wife has horses. He belongs to four clubs. He went to an Ivy League school. And here he is doing menial manual labor at the end because he was wrong.
Did it ever occur to you that maybe you were wrong? That the Democrats weren't in cahoots with the Russians or Castro?
I think that last image, I think, should be the price of fanaticism. That, you know, that for the people that think they're doing the wrong things for the right reasons, there is a price to be paid for that. And you see Howard Hunt, you know, his life is, as he knows it, over. He's in prison, his wife is dead, his kids are scattered, that you see the price he paid for doing what he thought was the right thing, but obviously in the end was completely the wrong thing to do.
We would love for people to do research and to go, what happened? What if this really happened? And what happened to Macha? What happened to Bernard Barker? What happened to John Dean? What happened to Magruder? What happened to all these people? We would love for people to just use this as a starting point. The other thing that we would love for people to do is just take a moment to question their own side, on the right or on the left, but just the sort of blind devotion to a cause is so dangerous. The unquestioning loyalty. And so I would love for people to go away and just question whatever it is they believe in, be it bad or good, just question everything. That was actually kind of a good outcome of Watergate, is that we started to question everything. I think that might be ebbing right now, but at the time, that was the one positive outcome, which was that the illusion had evaporated. We saw behind the curtain. We saw in the halls of power what was really going on. And I think that in a way it was useful.
In 1972, long before I worked as the Washington correspondent for New York Magazine, a loyal reader of the publication, Rita Sue Siegel, arrived at their offices on East 32nd Street with a strange object in her hands. She asked to see Milton Glaser, the magazine's co-founder. "I have a Nixon eggplant," she said. It was true. The eggplant she brought with her looked just like the guy, or as much like him as any nightshade could. The magazine decided to have Peggy Barnett photograph the vegetable, and to have it notarized. Today, I keep a large print of the Nixon eggplant in my home. Years ago, when Trump was still president, my fiancé's son, Aiden, stared up at it quizzically. He asked me, "Was Nixon worse than Trump?" I didn't know how to answer. That administration seemed to have a Watergate every 5 minutes. But no Cambodia. This was pre-insurrection. There was still time for Trump to carry out his most demented ideas. Like Nixon, he kept an enemies list. I should know, because I was on it. He was playing footsie with homicidal dictators, tempting them into a nuclear holocaust. And he was a paranoid asshole. But so was Nixon. The truth is that Trump could not have existed without Nixon. Not as a political player, at least. The same qualities seemed to motivate the people who helped bring them both to power. Some of Trump's people, in fact, came directly from Nixon's orbit. And the rest, well, they were molded in their image. Here's Mendel and Gregory again.
We do act like, oh, this is Trump, everything has changed. Everything has changed. No, I think it grew, it sprouted, it got exposed, but it's all been there. I'm sorry to say, to me, it's all been there. But there's a line in this show where Magruder, in talking about the Dita Beard story and dismissing it, you know, kind of shits on the liberal Washington Post. He doesn't say the word fake news, but if we were shitty writers and creators, we would have had him say fake news. You can imagine right. The bad version, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, none of this is new. It right. was all there. This idea that the other party isn't just simply the other party, but that somehow they are trying to destroy America. That takes flame under Nixon.
Yeah.
And that flame in different forms, it carries us right to today.
Of course.
Nixon was a sinister motherfucker. Like, Trump, all of Trump's stuff, he tells you the evil that he's doing. He tweets it. He talks about it openly. Nixon had this veneer of civility, and then all this really evil stuff was happening behind the scenes. He's a much more sinister character, and I think it's important that people don't go, oh, Watergate was quaint. Like, the crime of Watergate, the cover-up, with small potatoes compared to some of the stuff going on. But the person, very dangerous, very sinister man.
And the same true believerism that nothing can go wrong, that COVID can't hurt me, mm-hmm. that vaccines are fake, whether you want to say that these people are really believe it, don't believe it, secretly don't believe it, I don't know or I don't care. But again, that's Hunt,
yeah.
That's Liddy. The insanity, the I'm going to go all in. I'm with you. And the oh, you have no regard for me and you will cut me loose the second I'm no longer helping you. That's as much what this is a show about. Not about the presence he eventually got brought down. It was the decision to put their work above family and the price that Hunt paid for it in particular. I am not asking anybody to like these guys, and I'm not asking anybody to think they were great, or this is not a reevaluation of them. I'm not even sure I'm looking for sympathy for them. But I am asking you to understand them a little.
The White House Plumbers podcast is a production of HBO and Campside Media. All five episodes of this podcast were hosted by me, Olivia Nuzzi, and produced by Natalia Winkleman. Hannah Baker is our story editor. Our associate producer is Charlotte Morley. Fact-checking by Annika Robbins. At Campside Media, our executive producer is Josh Dean. Editing and sound design by David Devereaux. Additional engineering support from Ewan Lai Tremuin and Harry Krinsky. Special thanks to Michael Gluckstadt and Savon Slater at the HBO podcast team. Maynard Kay, Veronica Geronimo, Nicholas Park, and Eileen Holland on the motion creative team. And Lexi Barco, Jennifer Garay, and Jennifer Holliner at HBO Media Relations. We'd also like to thank all of the creators, cast, and crew who took the time to participate in this podcast, particularly David Mendel, Frank Rich, Alex Gregory, and Peter Hike, as well as Garrett Graff. And our producer, Natalia, would like to shout out Rich Summer for getting her into the premiere after party. All of us are in agreement that Rich Summer is a very nice man. We had such a great time making this podcast. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Thank you for listening.